Well, good afternoon and welcome to Talk of the Towns. We try to go beyond the headlines to make sense of the issues facing Maine communities, to share what works and to seek alternative solutions. Talk of the Towns is aired on WERU Community Radio since 1993, dedicated to the proposition that everyone benefits when we share our knowledge, our experience, our concerns, and our perspectives. We're about to practice the magic of community radio, in which those of us in our virtual studio and you who are listening create a kind of dialogue we hope will be of benefit to our friends, our neighbors, and colleagues. We're your hosts, Ron Beard and Liz Graves. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour and Talk of the Towns. And a reminder that we're recording this show in advance and won't be taking any calls today. Well, as we make way for winter, there is a kind of clarity in the air. The slant of sun opens us to new perspectives. Maine writers seem especially attuned to the seasons, and in a new collection of essays, they write about what brings them most alive all year long. We're so happy to have the co-editor of this new collection. It's called Alive to This, a series of essays by 20 Maine writers. It's published this year and by Littoral Books, and Kara Douglas is the co-editor. Welcome to you, Kara.
Thank you. Thanks for having us here today.
Sure. And Carl Little, I call Carl not an art critic, but an art illuminator. He's so generous with his introduction to art and arts-related materials, and he's a writer of his own. His latest collection of poems is called Blanket of the Night. It's published just recently by Deerbrook Editions.
That's right, Ron. Thanks.
Thanks.
Glad to be here.
And Robert Diamente is a contributor to the essays in this book called Alive to This. He's a photographer, wonderful photographer. He lives in Bangor. Welcome to you, Robert.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, perhaps each of you could say a little bit more. Robert, we'll start with you. You've had a varied career, both as a photographer and writer. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. I am a writer and a visual artist, mostly known for my photography, as you point out. I've had about a 30-year career in the jewelry industry. Carl and I have had a little crossover in that sense, and some of his writings on artists and my photography of their pieces have been in articles together. I've been writing all my life, but I just really began publishing within the last decade. It kind of took me a number of years to feel it was time to come out, so to speak, and start publishing and putting my work out there. My home base for the past 22 years has been Bangor, but I've lived in other places. And I feel like my ability to travel is part of my aliveness.
Great, great. Oh, Carl, a little bit more about yourself, if you would, just introduce yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Robert, for that memory of our collaborations, as it were. At Ornament Magazine, I'm still writing for them. It's been a great journey, but I was always a great admirer of your photographs of everybody's jewelry pieces here in Maine. So I've been a writer for a long time, specializing in art writing, but I also worked for 20 years for the Maine Community Foundation. So that was a wonderful wonderful experience. I love being with that crew. I live on Mount Desert Island, where I enjoy swimming in Echo Lake whenever I can. And I know, Ron, you do too. So it sort of makes sense that my piece for Alive to This would be about swimming.
Great.
There you have it.
Great. And Kara, a little bit about yourself, and we'll talk a little bit about your contribution to the book.
Sounds good. I live in Harpswell, Maine. I've been here for about 16 years, and I live in an old farmhouse with a small orchard and a barn that we decided to repurpose as a yoga and meditation studio. So I've been teaching here for about 10 years now. Prior to that, or kind of concurrent with that, I spent quite a bit of time, maybe 11 or 12 years, writing for a small local newspaper called the Harpswell Anchor. The Anchor has been reimagined since COVID as a nonprofit and is really thriving. I am, for better or for worse, no longer writing for the Anchor, which I miss, but largely because during COVID, it took everything I had just to keep my own little small business afloat and keep my family moving in the right direction. I have two daughters. One is in her first year of college. One is in high school. My background before doing all of this is in education and environmental science. So that sort of informs all of the things that I do.
Well, thank you. Let's see, big waves in a small kayak. You talk a little bit about what kind of brought you to think about creating a series of essays with some other Maine writers. Tell us a little bit about that experience and then how it led to this wonderful collection of essays.
Yeah, I have a really long history of wilderness adventure. I've worked as a wilderness guide. I've spent lots and lots of time with people and solo out in different domains, underground, on the ground, on the water. About a year and a half ago, I had a break in between some classes and I took a good look at the marine forecast and the weather and everything was perfect. So I headed out in my kayak and the conditions on the water were not what they were predicted to be. And there must have been an offshore storm far enough away that it wasn't on our radar, but was causing havoc. So there were some really big swells. And I had the familiar experience of really having to just let everything else go away and just be right there in what I was doing and stay really focused. And that for me creates such a sense of really deep presence and connection. And by the end I was paddling around Bailey Island. I didn't go all the way around because there was a point where the conditions just were not really conducive to going any further. So I turned back. When I came back to shore, I had that. I felt like this renewed me on so many levels. And this happens to people, but sometimes we miss it. And the busyness of our lives turns us away from this real feeling of kind of humility and reverence and connection that can all converge to create this deep sense of aliveness. And as a writer, I wrote about it. And then I thought, you know, I really want to know how other people access this feeling. What brings this forth for others? And can we have that conversation among us? Because I think that feeling changes us and it changes how we connect with each other and it changes how we build community.
So who did you reach? Who did you reach out to in this second journey?
I first had a conversation with Agnes and Jim Bushell at Literal Books. They took a risk of saying, oh, yeah, we love this idea. So if you edit the collection, we'll publish it. I had no experience as an editor, only as a writer. But I said, OK, I reached out to a neighbor and very good friend, Erin O'Mara, who also she's worked in media most of her life. She's a wonderful writer. She also writes for the Harpswell Anchor presently. And she agreed to join me on the journey. And we invited writers who we knew, people who we knew who maybe hadn't been published, but enjoyed writing. Agnes and Jim reached out quite a bit. Maine Writers and Publishers helped connect us with writers. And we asked for submissions and here we are.
Great. Liz, you were going to follow up.
Yeah, so I love what you just said about how any insights about what makes each of us individually come alive or have that sense of their sort of self connection is connected to other connection. You know, so what you said was changes how we build community. I thought that was beautiful. What was the harvest on that line? What did you come to think about building community in the process of working on the project?
Largely, we found that what brings people alive, which we sort of expected, is very personal and unique to each individual. Often what we saw in these essays was that, and it's not true in every single one, but in many of them, there's some element of an obstacle or an unanticipated circumstance. And that new juxtaposition to our lives seems to wake up a dormant part of us. Mm-hmm. And then that dormant part of us kind of pulls us into paying attention differently. And now we have a new lens that we're seeing things through and that we're connecting through. And I feel like most of us are really willing to connect with someone who's in a vulnerable space in their lives. But if we don't share our vulnerability, then it is harder to build those enduring connections. Right. So this whole idea of asking for help or not asking for help Do I navigate my life? You know, do I pilot it on my own? Do I try to, exemplify this independence? Or can I say when something is challenging? And I think that little window of challenge kind of, because it puts us in a different position in our own lives, other people pay attention differently. And it sort of brings out the best in other people as well. We reach for each other in those moments. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a celebratory moment of aliveness or whether it's, wow, I'm really grappling with this thing and I'm very alive to it, but I'm also churned up about it and I'm in a place of unknowing.
Mm-hmm. I think
there.
This is a wonderful counterpart to Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. It's kind of the personal side rather than the hero. We're all heroes in our own stories. And this kind of challenge and the ability to reach out, that is a journey. Yeah.
For sure.
Robert, let's learn more about you. And I'll ask you at the end of our short conversation to read from your essay in the new publication Alive to This. Your background in fine arts and photography, jewelry, your essay, which is titled All the Gods and Any Gods. Maybe Joseph Campbell is listening in to this. Talk a little bit about what led you to this particular essay.
Well, first, I'm going to say it's very interesting you thought of Joseph Campbell, because he definitely came to mind when I was reading Carl's essay in mm-hmm. particular, for reasons that maybe we will get to later on when we have more of a conversation about Carl's piece. In terms of my own, this essay is really illustrates, perhaps in an epic way, my discernment process. I decided to go to seminary about 10 years into my career as a photographer for a number of different reasons. And I think you'd have to read the essay to really fully appreciate all of those reasons. But it certainly was a decision that only I could have made, really only I could have made. And that's the conclusion I came to by the end of the essay. Because I had been asking all of these external questions, like, should I do this? Should I do this? Should I do this? And some people might call it a discernment process in a sort of religious sense. It is a calling. I did not consider it a calling. I still really don't consider myself a religious person, but I'm deeply embedded in the spiritual and I'm deeply embedded in understanding religions. To throw out a huge word, the epistemology of religions and things like that. So
we talk about epistemology on this show all the time. You're good.
I love epistemology. Okay, yes, let's throw that word around.
It's true.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Thank you for that, Liz. So things got very serious in my head very quickly, but I thought, oh, I can't go to seminary. I'm not that person. You know what is this thing? So I really turned it around in my head, and the essay that I wrote had been written before. It was a very short essay that I had published in a different magazine that is no longer, it's defunct. Unfortunately, it was a great magazine. But anyway, I had a very short essay, and I felt very dissatisfied about that edited down version of my discernment process. And so when I caught wind of this essay book, I lunged on Kara and said... and asked her, hey, I've got this essay I really want to flesh out, and it's probably the most important decision I've made in my life, and I would like to expound on it. And she was so kind and said, sure, send it in. And so here we are.
So. I'll just remind listeners that are tuned to Talk of the Towns. We're talking about a new publication called Alive to This, exploring essays on living fully by 20 Maine writers, published by Littoral Books this year. Robert, would you like to kind of read? You've set this up, and I know we don't like spoilers, but could you read the last part of your essay for us, and then we'll talk a little bit more. I think we'll have you start on the top of page 105. You've got that right there?
Yeah, I do. I have it in front of me. Would you mind, Ron, if I just backed up like a couple lines?
Sure.
Paragraph before, because I think it does help understand the essay, and I will just sort of set it up. I start off the essay, I'm in Salzburg, Austria, staring out over the Untersberg, thinking about, my life, as one does. Right. This is 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. So this process happened 20 years ago. I begin the essay that way, and I end the essay on in Salzburg. And in between is the process that got me to there, to that moment. After my return to Maine, I matriculated into a seminary. It was a stealth affair, for I was embarrassed by my nascent vulnerability. Seminary was the last place I could imagine myself attending. I questioned the calling many times, although the calling is exactly what it felt like. I refused to believe that something beyond my own will could be compelling me to explore the religious constructs I had feverishly rejected. There is doubt and there is disbelief. My feet were firmly rooted in the latter. A person doesn't simply waltz over the line into the enemy camp just because one is curious about the nature of the enemy, but that's exactly what I was being compelled to do. What I wanted was a sign, something extraordinary, unambiguous. So I did what the living do when we find ourselves in such a position. I turned to the dead. Communing with my mother might have been easier by visiting her grave in New Jersey, yet here I am in Salzburg with her ghost. It's a vacation of sorts, and together we are discovering someplace new. Choosing Salzburg wasn't difficult. She loved the sound of music. I think about what has brought me here, the unanswered questions I had as a boy, the terrible betrayal by a zealous teacher, anger at the death of my mother, and then finally the epiphanies in India that forged this new path into theological inquiry. The question that has been troubling me the most and has led me here to Salzburg is one that looms larger than the majestic mountain in front of me. Matriculating into seminary had been easy. I have done everything to get myself to the door. Yet how do I pass through? So, Mother, I say, imagining she is beside me, what should I do? Entschuldigung, Sie bitte. A young couple, arm in arm, is standing beside the bench looking down at me. I didn't see them approach and wonder if they had heard me talking to my ghost. I suspect not. The girl is teary-eyed and sniffles out, Haben Sie ein Taschentuch? 1 year of high school German is enough for me to understand what she wants. I rummage through my bag and pass her a travel-sized packet of Kleenex. She takes one, then tries to hand the rest back, but I shake my head. Alles für dich bitte. She dabs at the corners of her eyes, thanks me, and the couple walks on. And I begin to wonder why she's crying. I make up stories. They had been fighting. He had proposed. They are walking after a funeral. I could go on, but I will never know the truth unless I chase them down and ask with my imperfect German, warum, why? Stories are what we create in the absence of knowing. They point to things, contain information that may illustrate essential truths, make sense of or elongate abstractions, oftentimes exploring truth in a roundabout way. It is okay to question them, which is really what I have been doing all along. Questioning doesn't dismiss truth, it invites it in. Maybe all along I've been directing my inquiries toward the wrong people, which is why I have felt so dissatisfied and so lost. My question isn't really what I should do, it's something else entirely. So I ask myself, what do you believe in? It is a very reasoned question for which I have no reasoned answer. Certainly my relationship with religion is complicated, though it exists beside a deep spiritual longing. Then I hear another voice, and thankfully it's in English. The words are clear. It's as if somebody has whispered them into my ear. It doesn't matter what you believe in, just believe in something. Discernment mirrors our soul's deepest desires. I am not surprised by this numinous appeal. Truly, it feels like a reminder. But one thing for sure, it was not my mother that spoke to me just then, nor anyone recognizable. Possibly it was my own conscience or my own moral compass that has chosen to find its voice, but I doubt that. To consider the words divine inspiration is fine, though not from the singular deity of my youth, that man on a cloud. I will settle for all the gods and any gods. Those larger and more magnificent than any of the cartoon notions bequeathed to me. Perhaps later in life I will understand this moment, discover an explanation, or invent stories about it, any one of which a person might believe in. But for now, the words are enough. Just believe in something. I am closer to an answer, closer to the door. My sole task now is to rise and walk through.
Thank you so much. Robert Diamante, reading from his essay, All the Gods and Any Gods, in the new publication called Alive to This, Exploring Essays on Living Fully by 20 Maine Writers, published this year by Littoral Books. Kara, Carl, any questions? Liz, any questions or follow-up? Or do we let that just rest there?
Well, I encourage everybody to read the full story, because the section that takes place in India is really, truly remarkable. There's one part of it where Robert describes an older woman in the river that is just stunning. So I would recommend everybody read the whole thing. Beautiful reading.
That older woman in the river who you described, I actually think of her every time I go. I like to go into the cold ocean as often as I can for short periods of time. And she actually comes to mind as I get into the water. I think of that image from your essay.
How interesting. We all have water as a sort of a motif, as a sort of a cleansing motif, or a benediction, as Carl put it, or some sort of a ritualistic thing. I will say one thing about that moment, and we've talked about my background as a photographer. It was the only time during my trip in India I did not bring my camera with me. I sat there watching this experience without my camera, and it forced me into the humanness of the situation. I didn't have the camera to block the experience. It was incredibly liberating, but at the same time, I think that's a lost shot. But it exists in my head, and it now it exists in the essay. So thank you.
I got goosebumps. I had forgotten the vignette about the young woman crying at the park bench, and I sort of got goosebumps just now listening, because what I was thinking when Kara was talking a moment ago about connections and in that general way, I was thinking, it's when you witness another human being cry, it opens something us in most of us that witnessing does. And then there you were reading the vignette about exactly that. It was pretty cool.
It's so interesting, Liz, because I really struggled with whether to keep that in. It really happened. And it happened just like I described it. And I thought, was this superfluous? But what it did is it prompted that storytelling, that we tell ourselves stories, we make up stories, and it sort of relates to the broader experience of this narrative. So thank you for bringing that up.
That's the other thing I was thinking. I know we need to move on, but I'm so excited. Beautiful way, and Kara, having been inside the building of it, probably has a distinct experience of this, but the ways the essays talk to each other. So many of the other essays explore what Robert was just talking about, the idea of the stories we tell ourselves and what they are and what they mean or what they don't mean. So the whole book is this beautiful hooked rug. Okay, I'll shut up.
Great, Liz. Why don't you lead us into...
I'm next. Okay, I don't have
you're
to shut
next.
Up.
Yep.
Beautiful. Okay, so I too love to swim in Echo Lake. It's been too long, so next year let's all do it together.
Deal.
And Carl's piece in the book is called The Pond of Life. And I have a toddler that I'm thinking a lot about what I am to read to him and what it will mean and what he will remember. So Carl starts off with remembering his mother reading to him and his siblings and The Grapes of Wrath, and also a book about a bear. Tell us about the bear to get us started.
Yeah. So I think I heard about this essay collection to submit through the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. And so I started to think about things that brought me alive, and that led me directly to Sergeant Mountain Pond, but I had to get there somehow. And so one of the ways I got to it was through a book called A Biography of a Grizzly that my mother read to me when I was little, a book that really had a profound effect on me. the author Ernest Thompson Seton has been criticized for sort of, you know, making animals too human. And I was like, I don't care. I want this bear. I want it, you know. And there was one particular incident in the story where Wob is kind of in his middle age, shall we say, and kind of feeling all of his joints and wounds and everything. And he comes across this very smelly body of water up in the mountains, and something compels him to go into it, to slip into it. And suddenly his whole body is renewed. And so that was sort of the setup for going to Sergeant Mountain Pond, because I feel the same way up there. Anyway, so I'll read the last
Great.
Section. Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
And I should mention that the name of the grizzly was Wahb, Wahb. So that comes in at the end. If you hike to the pond via Penobscot Mountain, at one point where trails converge in the forest, you walk through a kind of natural entrance formed by a couple of behemoth glacial erratics. Another scene from literature inevitably enters my head at that moment, when the children enter Narnia through the fur coats in the closet and C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Knowing what lies just a short distance ahead, I feel like I've entered an enchanted place and have left behind a troubled world. What makes the pond even more special now is sharing it with grandchildren. Last summer, three of them, Maria 10, Sarita 9, and James 6, took their maiden swim across the water to the far side and back, a couple of hundred yards, I'd say, eyeballing it. When we reached the rock that serves as a kind of resting spot on the far side, we spied a bullfrog sitting on the branch of a dead tree that stretched out of the water nearby. Each of us in turn swam up to be nearly nose to nose with the wondrous creature, who didn't flinch. We respected his perch. The frog put up with our friendliness. The pond is vibrant with life. In addition to frogs, dragonflies and darning needles zoom from pad to pad, sometimes resting on someone's stationary head or hand. There are birds in the surrounding trees and water bugs scurry here and there. Asked what they felt about the pond, each grandchild had a different response. The pond makes me feel fresh and new, Maria said, while Sarita called it a reward for hiking. James, the youngest, described it as big, fun, cool, like cold, and refreshing. Their mother, my daughter Emily, said she could feel the electricity of the pond during that July swim. It felt so alive that it was actually something I could feel pulsing and hear vibrating in my ears, she recalled. She turned to science and her experience as a nurse practitioner to explain the sensation. She wrote, "Our heart is a pump, but part of what triggers it to pump is its electrical system. That's why people sometimes need a pacemaker. The pacemaker gives the electrical command for the heart to beat. I felt like I could hear that electricity, the pacemaker of the pond, when I went underwater. Can't wait to be underwater again." It is difficult not to invoke religious terms for what happens. Sergeant Mountain Pond provides a benediction, a blessing, a baptism to the visitor who slips into its cool embrace. Here is where, like Wahb, I find new life.
Well, thank you, Carl. Carl Little reading his essay in a book called Alive to This. No secret there. His essay was called The Pond of Life. Robert, Kara, any responses or questions? Liz, any questions?
I'll jump in. I want to hear what Kara says too, but I thought of this when we sat down this morning, that there's a song I love. It's been covered by so many people that I'm not positive who actually wrote it, but I believe it's the artist Anja Dufko, whose name I'm sure I'm mispronouncing. And the song is called Sweet Spot, and the beginning of one of the verses is, "May it only sting a moment when you dive into the blue. This is the sweet spot of your life, because by the time you reach the surface, it has rearranged you." I'll send you the song, but that's what That's what it made me think of this morning.
Great.
Yeah, there is that initial sting, as it were.
Yeah. Kara?
One of the things I love about the way your essay progresses, Carl, is that you walk along these trails through the glacial erratics, and it's almost like at that moment, the known and predictable world kind of temporarily stays behind. So there's one layer of revealing or shifting into a new space. Then you get into the water and it's this deeper lens. And then on the other side of the pond, you're looking at the frog and the dragonfly and the darning needle. And it's like there's this progression of lenses through which there is one layer of deeper connection and then another and then another. And it's almost like it funnels in and becomes, it moves from the macrocosm to the microcosm and really sort of brings you into the details of what is happening there. And I really appreciate that about how this essay progresses.
Mm. Oh, thank you, Cara. That it was fun to think it out and to, you know, find a way to get to that pond. And I did want to mention, Ron, you put this in the notes about Catherine Schmidt. She's a wonderful biologist, naturalist from the Skudik Institute. And she's written beautifully about this particular pond. And one of the special attributes of this pond is it's said to have been the first pond to have ever formed in Maine because of its height. When the glaciers retreated, that was one of the first places, you know, a pond could show up. And so that just sort of added to the whole wonder aspect of the place.
Sure, sure. Wow.
Thank you. Yeah,
I feel alive as we listen to your wonderful writing. Kara, let's stay with you and talk a little bit about On Falling. You mentioned your connection to the land in Harpswell that features an apple orchard. Tell us a little bit about what led you into your essay.
When we first moved here, so to be clear, this apple orchard only includes 6 trees, but they're very, very old. And one of the ways that we have dated the age, because there are not clear, the town records burned at some point, so we don't have clear records of when our house was built or when anything really happened here over the long stretch of time. But we know the house was built sometime around the mid to late 1850s. And several years ago, I was working out in the garden and an enormous limb, this is described in the essay a little bit, so I won't go into detail too much. An enormous limb fell from the tree. And my kids and I were able to count growth rings all the way back to 1860. And then the rings got too compressed to be able to distinguish one from another. So we know that this tree has been here since at least then. And the other trees are probably of similar age. We've spent a lot of time rehabilitating them. And the people that we bought our house from had also invested a lot of time in taking care of them. John Bunker is just a wealth of knowledge about apples in the state of Maine. He's kind of made it his mission to go around and find all of these apple varieties that would otherwise probably go extinct, and has helped to keep them alive through the Maine Heritage Orchard. He's come to my house and helped me figure out how to identify some of these trees, how to graft them, how to keep them healthy. He's been just instrumental throughout the state of Maine in doing some of that work. And the essay I wrote was about during a snowstorm last spring, watching a second limb fall from this really revered tree in my backyard and knowing that there aren't very many limbs left.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you read that portion, that conclusion to your essay, if you would, please?
Absolutely. So I'll jump in where I'm reflecting on how this particular tree is a Baldwin. And Baldwins are rare in Maine because of a really difficult growing year quite some time ago. And this explains some of that. Temperatures in Maine during the winter of 1933 and 34 dropped as low as minus 40 degrees. The bays froze solid as they often did then. Vast temperature swings of 50 degrees or more happened in 12 and 24 hour periods. almost all of the Baldwin trees in Maine perished. John Bunker writes, "No one will ever know why any Baldwins made it through the winter alive. Somehow, this magnificent Baldwin in my yard survived. Maybe 1933 was not a bearing year for this tree. Maybe it survived because it hadn't produced apples, because it had rested. Maybe being close to the coast moderated the temperatures just enough. Maybe it's simply a survivor, mystery unsolved. 90 years later, I'm shaking snow from my Baldwin's limbs, trying to recall the words to the Gettysburg Address delivered when the tree was still a sapling, as my arms burn from flailing my shovel overhead. These ancient trees stand witness, patient, unmoving, as the world changes all around them. When the witness falls, who holds this ground? I lean my dripping forehead against the rough trunk and breathe in the scent of April snow, hoping some deep Baldwin patience will seep into me. I recall the teachings on impermanence. All things arise, persist, and subside as conditions support their existence, their thriving, their dissolution. It aches to accept this truth. We know our children will grow up and move on. Our bodies will age and fail. Our favorite old pair of jeans will someday be too holy to wear. We know these trees will fall. We sometimes deny these truths, push them away, armor ourselves against them. But today, in the midst of another power outage, wind driving through every crack in the barn door, the horses shaking snow from their manes, and the kids sulking about the lack of internet, I have no strength for armor. I watch my revered Baldwin let its limb go under the weight of April snow, and I feel it splinter me open with sadness and reverence and wonder and joy that I'm even here to be in all this. I consider how vastly the world has changed in the lifespan of this venerable tree. Limb by falling limb, perhaps our beloved Baldwin is telling us that its time approaches. Perhaps it's my turn to bear witness."
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful.
Wow.
Kara Douglas reading from her essay called On Falling in the wonderful new collection of essays called Alive to This. Any thoughts or questions? Robert, go ahead. Robert Dumanto.
Yeah. I'm glad you read that section, Kara. I was reading it again last night, and the line, "I recall the teachings on impermanence," just really jumped out at me. And it caused me to reflect on this great sadness in bearing witness to an ending of a life cycle, but also this idea of strength in the inevitable. And those strange moments of sadness also make us feel incredibly alive. And that, as a theme, I think comes through in a number of essays. It's like a sublime beauty of transformation. And Well, certainly in your essay, I feel like you've captured that. But how did that appear as a theme throughout the book for you? And maybe Erin, if you can speak on behalf of her.
Yeah. I think that it kind of goes back to that feeling of vulnerability, that just being able to speak from and act from where we are, being well enough connected within ourselves that we can stand in sadness, that we can stand in reverence is the word that keeps coming up for me. Reverence is there's so much aliveness in that feeling, because it is a little bit of sadness, but it's also a sense of acceptance at the same time. And a sense of being astonished. Like, there's such beauty in this sadness. And we did see that often in the essays, particularly, in essays that dealt with loss. There was a real sense of that reverence, that appreciation for what is and what we have or had, and a sense of, okay, there is also a going onward from here. There is something bigger than just this singular moment, and I'm riveted in this moment. And we saw that in many ways, how that moment of being riveted is like, maybe to use a photography metaphor, it's like there's a still shot, and that shot gets carried forward with us. It's like having a photograph to look back at. One of the essays is talking about being on a chairlift and on a ski mountain.
Wow, that's a beauty.
Yeah, beautifully written. And there's an unknown difficulty going on in the background, not in the background of the essay, but in the background of the writer's life and his brother's life. And the way that they connect and the images that hold presence for them are like these beautiful photographs of how they begin to rebuild. And it's just, we see that often in these essays.
I just want to remind listeners who they're listening to. And you've just heard from Kara Douglas, who is the co-editor along with Erin O'Mara. And she's a contributor to this wonderful collection of essays called Alive to This. And Robert Diamante is a contributor, also a photographer living in Bangor, and Carl Little in Somesville, Maine, a writer on the arts. And his latest collection of poems is called Blanket of the Night. So where would we like to go? I know that there's so many wonderful essays in this book, and I thought maybe each of you would just speak briefly about one of those. And Liz, I know you particularly like this essay about the chairlift.
Sure. Yeah. Let me see if I can tie together a couple of threads at once. Back for a moment to Cara's essay we were just discussing on falling and our discussion of it. I love that even in the section that you just read aloud for us, you have the word revered twice for the tree. Mm. And that's a, you know, relatively uncommon word and practice and orientation in our culture right now, it seems like. And so it just really pulled me up short. And I appreciated it. And it made me think this essay and the one that immediately follows it, also about apples, are both about, in very different ways, as you said at the beginning of our hour, asking for help. And you and that other author, whose name is Kate Kennedy, both consult experts and books. And it sounds like you had the opportunity to both talk to the apple guy. What's his name?
John Bunker.
Bunker. Sorry. I should know that. Both you consulted his book and you got to consult with him in person, which is a lovely blessing that we have and that we have right now in this gathering to have each other's words and company. And that Kate Kennedy in her essay, My Antonovka, goes back quite far too in written history to track down a particular apple. That was what I wanted to say about yours. And yes, I'll just share the name and title of this. And it's the essay you just mentioned about two men on a ski chairlift. And it's called The Light is Getting Brighter. And his name is Dave Patterson. And it was one of my favorites in the collection as well. It's about we hear what they're talking about and what they're not talking about in a very main guy kind of way. And it's also illuminating of their experience. So.
No pun intended, right? No pun intended.
Yeah.
Carl, what were some of the essays that you particularly liked?
Well, I also wanted to go back to Cara's apple tree, because I just feel like after reading that story that I'm never going to look at an apple tree quite the same way again. I mean, just to appreciate the history of it. And but I was also thinking of how special the experience is to witness a falling branch. And it reminded me of a story. My wife was recently running on the carriage trails in Acadia, and she was going by a tree with a very mossy base, and it seemed to be moving, like pulsing. And she stopped and she looked at it and she was going, "What is going on?" And she realized that it was about to fall. And she felt like, she compared it to our final breaths. I can't remember, there's a medical term for that, where you're basically making your final breathing and then you go. And she was watching this on the side of the trail and came back just sort of full of like what she had seen. And so I really appreciate how you have brought us into that scene and witnessing this falling branch. But I also want to say one of my favorite pieces is by Dana Wild. It's one of the shortest pieces in the book. It's called Within a Budding Grove, which is, comes from the second volume of Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. And it's it starts with this description, this again, a sort of a nature description of this wonderful blooming that takes place of the of this button bush. But then it just turns into this wonderful memory of love and passion and the fact that it takes place in June, which is my, I consider that my month. That's my birth month. It has just, it just resonated with me so much. Anyway, check it out.
Great. Robert, what were some, was another essay that you particularly appreciated in this wonderful volume, Alive to This?
I loved Dana Wild's as well. I will say that, Carl. It was such a beautiful piece. I've read it several times, and every single time I sort of burst out in tears by the end of it. It's just so extraordinarily beautiful. I liked the cadence that Kara and Aaron put together of the readings, because it really was, it's an emotional journey, but it's also a really great story. When you read them, you have to read them slowly because you really need to digest. From me personally, I needed to digest each one individually. But to go from J.J. Bolton's Saw story to On Falling, which is your story about a falling limb, and then go to Maya Antonovka, which the central theme is an apple, but also, you know, quite expansive. It was just very interesting. And maybe you can talk about like how you decided to put the book together.
Sure. I have to actually credit Agnes Bushell with ordering the essays, because we came at it from a whole variety of different, first we had put them in alphabetical order, not because we wanted to publish them that way, but just so that we could look at them objectively and figure out, okay, let's, this is just an ordering system. Let's start here. And then we looked for themes and we thought maybe we'd have sections of the book, but then it became clear that some of the sections would only have one essay and some would have six essays. And so we abandoned the theme idea. We placed them in different juxtapositions to each other. And then Agnes read through all, Agnes is the publisher, she read through all of them and decided what to move where and said, this is the, this is what I think makes the most sense, and sent it back to us. And at that point we sort of said, she has clearly done this more often than we have.
Wonderful.
We had some conversations about moving a few, but then, you know, one that I thought might be placed really well against another, someone else said, yeah, but if you pull that out from there, then you're missing this. So we left them with how Agnes ordered them. And I think she did that really well.
Kara, I know this puts you in a spot as the co-editor, but is there any other essay that you'd like to highlight out for us as we talk about this wonderful collection of essays?
Am I allowed to say all of them?
Yes, you can say that.
I do have one that really caught my eye the other day, though, because I've been slowly, you know, going back. Now that the book is out, I can read them and enjoy them in a way that is really different from how I read them at first. And there are just one that really caught me the other day was an essay near the end of the book called Dancing to the End by Mary Cushman. And she's telling the story of accompanying a minister who is going to a nursing home to visit one of his parishioners, and just her observations and experiences with the connection that this older man in the nursing home has with his minister, and how this just wakes him up and brings so much joy. And her observation, she has some, I could read the whole thing, but I won't, because you should read it. But she talks about, I'll read a couple lines. I didn't understand it back then, but over time I realized that if Michael and I had sowed courage in Hugh that day, we reaped it from him triplefold. As Hugh's own vitality shone out, rippling so sweet and strong among the three of us, I absorbed an indelible truth. The life force in us doesn't quit. Too often we assume that signs of its weakening mean it's gone or it will be. the closer someone gets to the end. It can become so buried under emotional debris that we think it's finished, but it almost never is. The life force in each of us isn't a substance that runs out. It's more like the press of the tide, dependable, oncoming, inexhaustible. And when we encourage the quickening of this force in others, it is not only life-giving for them, but gives us courage as well, perhaps inspiring us to dance to the end ourselves. Mm-hmm. I just think she said so well what this sense of aliveness brings. And it's when it's a surprise, when we do something regular, like stop by a nursing home, and that's the result. What a gift to everyone. Mm-hmm. All three of those lives are changed.
Sure. Well, we're approaching the end of the hour. I'm going to ask you a question to wrap up in a couple of minutes. But any other reflections on this wonderful collection? Anything that anyone wants to say about perhaps what reminded them of the process of coming to aliveness by reading the experience of other people?
Well, I was going to point out Gibson Faye LeBlanc's piece, because it's quite different from the rest. It's called Keeping Count. And it's basically 10 short pieces about keeping count of things that are going on in your life. And that ranges from every breath you take to how many mass murders there's been. It's quite amazing. And I, just to read one short section, number 5, I've also lost count of all the bodies that should still be breathing. And how many cities and how many churches, schools, cafes, clubs, clinics, train stations, bodegas, the numbers pass over and through my body like ghost particles, like standing in thigh-deep seawater while a 6-foot wave crashes over me. And I think, two. Mm. That is so powerful.
Mm. Thank you.
Amazing. Yeah. Thank you, Carl. That one made me think of in both directions, both about how we just got through Thanksgiving and time with elders in our lives, that when you're deciding whether or not to get together with a parent or a grandparent or whomever, one of the things on the scale is how many more of these are there left?
Yeah.
And then on the other end, my not quite 2-year-old, I recently acquired a goal of giving him 1,000,000 kisses before he leaves home. So I did the math and it's on the order of 170 a day. That gives me time to get it done in 16 years because I have not quite that much left.
Wonderful.
Can I do a shameless marketing pitch? And just
yes,
say,
please,
this
Robert.
Like this book is kind of the gift that keeps on giving, because as I pointed out, I've read through several of the essays more than once, and you really have to take your time between each essay to digest. So it's one of those, it's not a book you read through and then stick on your shelf. It doesn't gather dust. It's one of those things you sort of keep beside your bed, on the arm of your favorite chair. And it's just been really kind of great to have around, because every now and then I sit down and blast through another one again. And it really, it's really kind of great.
Well, thank you.
Cara.
We're going to wrap up, and I'll ask you each to reflect briefly on this kind of end of the year phenomenon that we're about to experience. The last few days of December are often time for reflection in preparation for a new year. And what do you imagine the essays in Alive to This offer us, especially those of us who are feeling the weight of the world, and as Carl just talked about the numbers that we might reflect on, the weight is there. What do some of these essays help us? How do they help us prepare for the new year? Carl, would you like to start?
I had to write this down because this is the way things are. But I wrote down. Hold on a second here. These stories allow us to witness the aliveness of others and maybe remind us that such aliveness helps us live our lives.
Mm.
That's what I felt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sharing those experiences,
right,
allowing us to come into their lives. Right. And there's an enormous amount of joy in it, but also grief, and there's laughter. There's, the whole range.
And what I take away is that these are 20 examples of the aliveness that's all around us. And we just have to take the time to ask the questions and ask people for their stories. Robert, how would you think about a preparation for a new year by reading some of these essays?
Oh, wow. I would say that it is about shared experiences. It's when you're reading these essays, you can identify, or perhaps not even identify with what the person is going through, but what you can do is empathize and take delight in the shared experience.
Thanks. And Kara, how would you characterize this as a preparation for any new year, whether it starts in January or anybody's anniversary?
Speaking specifically to the month of December is such a, it's sort of a cleansing month for me. It feels like that the darkness is one of those things that sort of nails me. And I really have to dig deep sometimes. And reading these essays is a really lovely way, I find, to not feel alone in that in that sense of darkness. That darkness comes in and out of our lives always. And these essays, some of them speak to that, and they also speak to delight, and they also speak to this sense of shared human experience. And so there's a real feeling of quiet connection. There, lucky me, I'm getting to know the writers in this book. I've had personal interactions with most of them at this point, but not all yet. But even if I didn't have that experience, I still come through it with a feeling of almost feeling more deeply connected and better understood, even though I didn't say a word. I read something that someone else wrote, and something in me feels understood.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you all. We've come to the end of a very short hour. Be sure and join us on this station from 4 to 5 on the second Wednesday afternoon of each month for Talk of the Towns. Our podcasts can be found in the archive section of the WERU website. If you have comments or suggestions for new topics, please email us at the address news@weru.org. Our theme music is a medley from Koronak on a Baumei House Highland Music recording. Thanks again to our guests, who are all contributors to a new book called Alive to This, published this year by Littoral Books. They were Kara Douglas, who is co-editor, Carl Little, contributor. He lives in Soamesville, writes on the arts, and his latest collection of poems is called Blanket of the Night by Dear Book Editions. And Robert Diamente, who is a contributor, he's a photographer, wonderful career in jewelry, and now as a writer. Thanks to our underwriters, thanks to Joel Mann for engineering our program. Stay tuned for Ralph Nader Radio from 5 to 6 and The Groove Shop from 6 to 8. Liz Graves and I are producers and hosts for Talk of the Towns, and this is Ron Beard wishing you a good afternoon.